today a class from Edgewood High School. Would you stand, please? Thank you very much. We appreciate your coming. You are part of the court's Court with Class program, and I'm sort of proud to announce on behalf of the court that this program has won two American Bar Association awards within the last year. And you have been given a summary of the case. There are additional summaries outside if you wish. And now that I have introduced you to the court, I would like to introduce the court to you. I'll start on my far left. That is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his right is Justice Jeanine Geske. To her right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. To his right is Justice John Wilcox. And at the far right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. With those introductions, I'll call the second case, 96-1440, Paul Weimer versus Country Mutual Insurance Company. Mr. Brueggemann representing the plaintiff, Paul Weimer.
May it please the court, my name is Larry B. Brueggemann, and I represent plaintiff appellant petitioner Paul A. Weimer, along with Hope K. Olson of my office. Essentially, there are two issues in this case. The first is whether two liability policies insuring two vehicles involved in a single collision can be stacked where the policies contain another insurance clause. The second issue is whether a letter offering policy limits is an effective tender of policy limits where the insurance policy indicates the insurance company will pay interest on a judgment, but its duty ends when it pays or tenders its limits of liability. The court is well aware of the facts in this case, so I won't go into them in detail, but it's probably well to review them briefly. On April 20th, 1990, defendant Trace was operating a dump truck with an attached trailer. He crossed the center line and collided head-on with plaintiff Weimer. The truck and trailer were insured under a business auto policy issued by Country Mutual. A separate premium for bodily injury liability coverage was listed for each of seven vehicles on this business policy. So the Trace company had seven vehicles, not just two vehicles. Separate premiums were charged for each of them. The declaration sheet indicated the limit of liability to be $100,000 per person, $300,000 per accident. In October of 90, counsel for Country Mutual Insurance sent a letter to counsel for Weimer stating that it was offering policy limits in the amount of $100,000 in full settlement of Weimer's claim against Country Mutual and Trace. In February of 91, counsel for Country Mutual sent a second letter to Weimer's counsel reaffirming the offer of policy limits. In June of 95, Country Mutual sought a declaratory order finding its limit of liability insurance available to Trace to be $100,000-$300,000. And over the objection of Trace and Weimer, the trial court ruled that only $100,000 was available to Weimer. In October of 95, the jury returned a verdict in excess of $600,000 in favor of Weimer. In March of 96, the trial court ordered that Country Mutual was liable to Weimer for only $100,000 in policy limits, and further ordered that Country Mutual was liable for interest on the sum of $100,000 from the date of verdict to the date of payment. In essence, the court rejected Country Mutual's position that it had tendered policy limits and had rejected Weimer's position that he was entitled to interest on the entire verdict. On appeal, the Court of Appeals affirmed the judgment limiting Country Mutual's liability to $100,000 and reversed the judgment limiting interest to the $100,000 policy limits, and found that Country Mutual was responsible for interest on the full verdict of some $600,000. So then, of course, Weimer filed a petition for review on the decision limiting Country Mutual's liability to $100,000, and Country Mutual filed a petition for review on the decision finding that it did not tender and therefore was liable for interest on the entire verdict. WIS Stats 631.43 is very important in this case. It prohibits insurers from limiting an insured to a single policy limit where the insured had purchased multiple policies for the same loss. Weimer argues...
That statute, there's a new statute involved that doesn't apply to your case, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Suppose the new statute was in effect.
Well, if the new statute were in effect, it would, in essence, indicate that this type of provision in the policy would be effective.
Okay. So the result, you wouldn't be here.
That's correct. And this is, I might add, this is a case of first impression and perhaps of last impression.
That's the point of my question.
Well, I guess we're here on one case, perhaps. But I do submit that certainly extrapolations could be made from the court's ruling in this case, despite the fact that it has limited application in this particular
situation. That's not true for the second issue.
That's correct. The second issue is actually a case of first impression as well, in essence, and that will have far-reaching ramifications because it will set the stage for this court's position with respect to what constitutes a tender and how formal a tender really must be.
And that would not necessarily be limited only to this kind of case.
That's correct. It would not be limited to this kind of case at all. If the court sets forth an outline as to what constitutes a tender, presumably it'll apply to all future cases in which tenders are being made. Now, I get the impression that the court is more interested in the second issue than the first issue, but I think it's important to point out that there are two cases which seem to be of significance in analysis of the first issue. The first is the Schult case, which involved the claim by the passenger of a non-covered rental vehicle against the driver, who was insured by rural insurance on three personal vehicles pursuant to a policy in which the driver paid three separate premiums for three separate vehicles. That policy contained a limit of liability clause. The court held that because the insured had paid more than one premium for liability insurance covering the same loss and was operating a non-owned vehicle, the limit of liability clause violated 631.43. Now, in Agnew, which was cited by the Intermediate Appellate Court, the insured owned three autos which had a separate policy, each of which contained a liability in limit of $25,000 per person per accident. A member of the insured's family or household was involved in an accident in an insured vehicle, causing over $75,000 in damages. In that case, the Agnew Court concluded that 631.43 did not apply to liability coverage for the operation of a specified owned vehicle because the insured had not paid separate premiums insuring against the same loss, but had paid separate premiums protecting against separate losses.
Well, now in this case, if you at least concede that we're not talking about the same loss, we could be talking about much different risks or losses. For example, the difference between a trailer, the trailer could be without the truck, it could be parked in the middle of the road and somebody could hit it. That is a different type of risk or loss, let's say loss, than it would be on the dump truck, for example. It, doesn't that distinguish this from, say, the cases that you mentioned? And you're talking about the same loss.
Your Honor, it is correct that when the two vehicles are being used separately, there would be a difference in the loss and a difference in the risk.
And a difference in the premium. So that's why you'd have a difference. You'd have a premium. You have one premium for one and one premium for the other.
Your Honor, it's the position of the appellant that there would be no difference in the premium. There may be a difference in the risk and a difference in the loss when they're used separately. But when they're used in tandem, the loss is the same and the risk is the same.
So what would that mean if he had seven vehicles and he had 300,000? So if you had, I was trying to visualize, if he had the pickup in the trailer together and they broke down, and then he went to pick up them with a dump truck, so he had all three of them in a line, and then they had an accident, it would be your position that each vehicle, the pickup, the dump truck, and the trailer would all have 100,000 insurance?
Yes, sir. If they're involved in the same accident, it's the position of the appellant that they would each have that coverage. And this is a position which the average policyholder would assume would exist, as Judge Dykeman points out in his dissent. And it also, I think, is the position which the legislature had in mind in passing 631.43.
But, Mr. Brigham, isn't that a difficult position to take as far as the reasonable expectation of the insured, given the clear limiting language in the policy?
Well, Your Honor,
you've got to assume that the reasonable insured is going to read the whole policy, not just look at the premium page.
There is limiting language in the policy, but there also is counterbalancing language in the policy indicating that there is coverage for each vehicle and there is coverage for each accident. The limiting language, it's asserted by my opponent, is the language which should be considered as governing. However, if one looks at the policy, it purely from a layperson's standpoint, one could come to the conclusion that there was coverage for each vehicle in each accident. And then, that being the case, then there is a question as to whether or not the policy is ambiguous on its face. And, of course, the court is aware of the law with respect to an ambiguity being construed against the party who drafts the insurance contract.
Well, the language says that the limiting language, regardless of the number of covered autos, and this would be, in this case, the truck and the trailer, claims made, the most we'll pay for all damages resulting from bodily injury to any one person, regardless of the number of vehicles, is, and then it goes on to say 100,000, 300,000. So that it seems to me to be, that seems to be clear language.
Well, Your Honor, if you refer to Part 2A, you will note that in the policy it states that the owned autos are covered for each of the coverages for which a premium charge is shown, and Part 4A states that the company will pay all sums, and I'm emphasizing all sums, as damages resulting from the use of a covered auto. And so, of course, as is pointed out, that is an issue in this case. Now, the appellate court had problems in this case. The intermediate appellate court has had problems in this case because the question about the opinion or the conclusion of a reasonable insured was addressed. And in the decision, the appellate court points out that that most holders of liability insurance coverage covering multiple vehicles would presume the multiple vehicle policy limits would apply when an injury arises out of multiple vehicles.
So he bought his 100, 300 policy, but technically he could have a $700,000 recovery if all vehicles were injured in the same accident.
That's correct, and Your Honor, I think it's important to note that this was a business risk insurance policy. That I think that if one were going to discuss this issue with any trucking company, The trucking company executive would be flabbergasted to think that if two or three semi-tractors and trailers collided at an intersection, injuring a fourth person, that trucking executive would only have one policy limit under circumstances such as we see in this case.
Well, let me just talk about what your emphasis is here. So far, I've heard from what I hear is that the language is ambiguous, subject to several interpretations, and you interpret it for the insured. I read the brief, and I read the Court of Appeals decision, really raising the issue of whether or not your other insurance provision or your limit of liability here violates, well, I'm sorry, whether the insurance companies violates the statute. And that if it violates the statute, you win.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, is that your major argument?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. It's the position of the plaintiff that there was one loss where multiple vehicles, which are insured by multiple policies, are involved in an accident. There is one risk, and that risk is that the two vehicles will, in tandem, cause an accident, and that when a loss results from that, there is only one loss.
All right. Now, let me just ask. Did the trial court rule here on the policy issue? Namely, that this policy does or doesn't provide multiple coverage?
Yes, the trial court issued that it does not provide multiple coverage.
So, because of 641, because of the statute, but I'm talking about in terms of insurance and reasonable expectation of the parties. Did it rule on that issue?
I do not believe, Your Honor, that it specifically addressed reasonable expectation.
That's what I thought. So, I mean, that wasn't really an issue at the trial court. Or if it was, that wasn't the ruling, because it went to a jury, and it ultimately went on the basis of the statute, if I understand what happened here.
Declaratory judgment was...
That's what the original proceeding
yes.
was. Okay, under the statute.
Yes.
All right. Now, let's look at Agnew, upon which you rely.
Yes, ma'am.
Agnew had two clauses. One, the drive the other car provision, and two, the two or more cars insured, which here looks like our limit of liability. Right?
Except in the Agnew case, the drive the other car provision was the one which was addressed.
Yes.
The other issue was not addressed in
right.
Agnew, which makes this case a case of first impression.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, I haven't...
What's your argument?
Pardon me?
So what's your argument under the statute?
My argument under the statute is that there was one risk and there was one loss. And the statute is designed to prevent insurance companies from escaping aggregation of coverage where there's one risk and one loss.
And had this been not involved, the trailer had not been involved, your position is you'd lose.
That's correct.
Okay.
Now, let me go to the second issue.
Before you do that, counsel,
yes,
why do you define the risk as one risk that two vehicles will in tandem cause the accident? I mean, isn't there an argument to be made that there is separate coverage, liability coverage for each vehicle, and the liability coverage is a liability for negligence causing injury?
Caused individually, did you say?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, Your Honor, it's interesting that you bring up this issue because it requires us to go into the facts somewhat in this case. In this particular case, the reason for this accident was because Trace had applied the brakes on the truck, and because of improper calibration between the truck and trailer brakes, the truck was pushed back and forth on the highway because of the trailer. The trailer had reached its harmonic frequency, which is similar to a pendulum, but in a different orientation. It caused the truck to go out of control. So here we had a situation where the whole issue dealt with Trace's loss of control due to the fact that the vehicle had reached its harmonic frequency due to the fact that the trailer brakes were not properly calibrated. So here is a prime example of where the two vehicles combined in one seamless event to create a loss, one inseparable loss, and a prime example where two vehicles created the risk.
Is the risk insured that is not in tandem with the motor vehicle? Can the trailer be insured independently?
Yes, ma'am. It was insured independently, and freestanding, it would have had its own policy limits freestanding. But when it becomes a part of a system, then it has a different type of risk than it has when it's freestanding. And that is the risk that as part of the system, it will cause the system to go out of control, which is what occurred in this case. So therefore, the risk then is the same as the truck risk, namely that there will be a loss of control and that a person will be injured, as we have in this case.
Others have used the term stacking. This is not a stacking case, because here you claim both vehicles caused the accident.
That's correct, Your Honor. That is absolutely true, and I probably should not have used the term stacking. And now I'm going to...
Yet the special verdict only asked regarding one vehicle. Was the person negligent in operation of the motor vehicle only asked with regard to one?
I'm not looking at the verdict right now, Your Honor, but that's my recollection, saying that was Trace negligent with respect to the operation of his vehicle, but I'd have to look specifically at the verdict.
I did.
Okay. All right, well, I've got my warning sign on now, so I'm going to move now to the issue which apparently has significance statewide and which I've addressed very, very superficially, or will be able to address very superficially. The issue, of course, is that of post-verdict interest. I'm not going into the provisions of the policy because I assume that you're aware of what they are. But basically, the policy language states that the defendant or the insurance carrier had a duty to pay interest on the judgment, and it further stated that the duty to pay interest ends when it pays or tenders its limits of liability. So the question in this case becomes whether or not it properly tendered its limits of liability. And as I pointed out earlier in briefly discussing the facts, there were two letters sent in which the counsel for the insurance company indicated that it would pay policy limits. It's the position of the plaintiff that certain formalities must be met in order to constitute a tender, and the intermediate appellate court basically agreed with the plaintiff's position and essentially indicated that in order for a tender to be truly a tender, the money has to be placed beyond the reach of the party who's seeking to establish a tender, and in that particular case, this wasn't done. The appellate court indicated that basically that the tender had to be an unconditional offer to perform, and that there had to be a production of the subject matter of the tender, neither of which occurred in this case. And essentially, we take the position that the appellate court, of course, was correct in this position. The appellate court cited the Estreen case in which the court held that in a real estate transaction, the money, quote, had to be placed beyond the use, unquote, of the person making the tender. That wasn't done in this case. And so, essentially, the tender was ineffective. The insurance company could have made the tender effective by sending out the money or by filing it with the clerk of court, but it chose not to do so.
Would this be an industry standard, and you'd like that the minute that they offer the policy, they have to send the money into court or send it somewhere? Is that what you're stating? Because that sort of, having done some practice years ago, that sort of defies what happens. You have the letter, it goes out, and they say, we're responsible, we have $100,000 insurance, and we're offering $100,000.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that something more formal must be done. For example, in this case, there was no offer of, or there was no tender of any type of release. This was a case involving multiple defendants, and I do not believe that it would be prudent for the court to hold that a simple letter saying we will pay policy limits is adequate, because there are so many issues which arise in connection with the payment of policy limits that it should be incumbent upon the insurance carrier or the party seeking to make the tender to set forth an unconditional type of situation so that the recipient knows exactly what the tender is and exactly what the terms and conditions of the tender.
Well, what would they have been here that might have been acceptable? Pardon? Except for the, what, like what here? What should the insurance company have said here?
Well, in this particular case, the insurance company could have set forth some proposed language of a pairinger nature, perhaps. That may have been one thing which it could have done, which was not done in this case. And now, of course, I think it's important to point out that in the Estreen case, the court indicated that the money had to be placed beyond the use of the party attempting to achieve the tender. It simply has to be placed beyond the use of that party. And so we may not even get to the issue that you bring up, Justice Abramson, as to what it should have specifically done beyond putting the money beyond its use.
Counsel, your time has expired. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you
very much. Mr. Jacobson, you represent the Country Mutual Insurance Company.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
My name is James J. Jacobson. I'm from the law firm of Piet and Jacobson, and our firm represents the defendant, respondent, petitioner, Country Mutual Insurance Company. In regards to the first issue before this court, and that is the issue of whether or not there are two limits here, the issue involving Section 631.43 could theoretically be determined before there's any type of accident using the analysis and the rationale in the Agnew case. You can look at the statute, as the court did in Agnew, and determine that you have to find out if the policies insure against the same loss. Then what you could do is look at the policies themselves to make that determination. And that's the difference that we have with the petitioner here. And that is, the petitioner connotes that the term loss is the actual damages that occur, whereas it's our position that the term loss refers to the type of risk that is insured against. And in the petitioner's reply brief, they try to make that distinction, and that they say that Agnew does not, in fact, refer, or that loss does not mean the same thing as risk in Agnew. And in Agnew, in fact, those two terms are used interchangeably in under on page ...349 at Wisconsin 2nd, and that's in the second full paragraph, where the terms risk and loss are used interchangeably. So Agnew does control here. The distinction that the petitioner tries to draw, that you have to look at the facts of the accident itself and see if the same damages are occurring, is not correct. Rather, the policy insuring the trailer insured against damages arising out of the use of that trailer, whereas the truck insured against damages arising out of the use of of the truck. Therefore, those insure against two different losses. Therefore, Agnew's is applicable here, and 631.43 is not applicable. And therefore, then you look at the language of the policy. And the language of the policy is clear and unambiguous.
Well, Agnew, of course, did not relate to that language in that policy. It related to the other clause. So it didn't decide that issue.
It didn't decide this particular issue, correct. The issue that I'm referring to is what constitutes a loss. Is that the terms, same loss, as that's used in the statute. Your
Agnew
honor.
Looked to a prior case. Was it Wood?
Correct.
Said you have to look at the facts of each particular case. The analysis is made on a case-by-case basis as to whether the particular liability policy at issue promises to indemnify the insured against the same loss as the other insurance policy involved.
Exactly, Your Honor. You have to look at the facts in the policy language. Correct, Your Honor. And as I just said, the policy insuring the trailer insured against loss arising out of the use of the trailer, whereas the truck insured against loss arising out of the use of the truck. Therefore,
in this case, the loss arose out of the use of both.
But the policies, correct, the policies insure against different losses in that it is the loss arising out of the use of the truck and also the loss arising out of the trailer, which the respective policies insure against. So they do not insure against the same loss, and therefore the statute is not applicable. And then we look at the language of the policy, and the clear, unambiguous language of the policy says that regardless of the number of vehicles or the number of insurance policies that there is, or vehicles involved, excuse me, they will only pay the single limit. And Your Honor had earlier asked the question about whether or not the ambiguous argument was raised at the trial court. It was raised again at the Court of Appeals, and it was not addressed by the petitioner in their petition or briefs before the court. So
did you say it was raised at the trial court or not?
It was briefed, Your Honor.
And what did the trial court say?
The trial court ruled that Agnew applied, that the statute did not apply, that the language was clear, and that therefore the single limit language did apply. And Justice Wilcox had asked earlier, or had talked earlier about the policyholder has a duty in Wisconsin to read the entire policy, or would be expected to read the entire policy, and that is, in fact, the case in Wisconsin, and that a policyholder does have the duty to read a policy. And as the Court of Appeals determined, the only way that an insured could come to the conclusion that there would be two policies applicable when reading the which autos are involved or the types of damage insured would be to totally disregard the single limit language. And as the Court of Appeals also pointed out, the which autos are insured does nothing more than say which autos are insured under the policies. Additionally, what we will pay talks about the types of damages that will be covered and does not negate the single limit provision.
Mr. Bergman, however, argues facts by saying that something went wrong with the balance or whatever of the trailer. This caused the trucks to go out of control. So aren't they really both involved in the same accident?
Well, I was not part of the trial. I was retained on the declaratory judgment action. I don't believe that any part of the trial transcript is before the court. As Justice Bradley pointed out, the verdict talks about the negligence of Mr. Trace, not about what caused the accident. But I would still hold the position that the policies insure against separate and distinct losses, and once That, for once we come to that conclusion in 631.43 is not applicable, then the clear language of the single limit provision holds that we will that Country Mutual only has an exposure of 100,000.
What loss is insured vis-a-vis the trailer?
The loss that is insured vis-a-vis the trailer is for damages or liability arising out of the use of that trailer.
One of the things that concerns me about the Agnew case and distinguishing it, you say that Agnew is applicable, and it seems that at the very end of the Agnew opinion, there is some weight given to the fact that the policyholder did not purchase coverage for this type of loss. However, in our fact situation, there is no dispute that there was money paid for a loss and for the risk.
Correct. I cannot dispute that there was a premium paid for a loss or risk arising out of the use of the trailer. But again, that is not the same risk or loss for which premium was paid for use of the truck. And because 631.43 is therefore not applicable, we look to the language of the policy, and the language of the policy is clear in stating that if such a situation arises, then the limits or exposure to the insurance company is one single, in this case, $100,000 limit.
What kind of liability, I want to just one more time, for the trailer? How can the trailer, give me a fact situation, how the trailer can be negligently operated if not in tandem with the tractor?
If not in tandem
with a motor vehicle.
Well, there would be, it could be used in tandem with a truck that's not insured underinsured by Country Mutual. Say if it was insured by State Farm or American Family, then the limit of the single limit provision would not be applicable, and theoretically you could recover whatever limits there were under the American Family or State Farm insured vehicle truck, and then you could also recover under the Country Mutual trailer. Other examples, one of which was in our brief, if someone was unloading the trailer, and because of the way the trailer, the materials were loaded on the trailer or a defect in the trailer, was injured in unloading the trailer, that's a situation where this would apply, where the insurance would apply. But your question was just limited to
The risk is for the negligent operation of the trailer and someone unloading the trailer. I don't know how that falls in.
Well, suppose you didn't park the trailer properly and it rolled.
Correct.
Unconnected with a truck. That would be an example.
Correct. Exactly. The tender issue. As the plaintiff has pointed out, there were two tenders or two letters offering the policy limits to Mr. Weimer. One was in October of 90 and the other in February of 91. The Wisconsin courts have not addressed the construction of the term tender in the context of tendering the policy limits of an insurance contract. But it's well-established law in the state of Wisconsin that words used in an insurance contract are to be given the common and ordinary meaning which they have in the minds of an average layperson. And as we've set forth in our briefs, tender, when it's defined in a dictionary such as the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language, says an offer of funds or service in payment of an obligation. Now, if we look at a thesaurus, and you look at the word offer, it refers to present, tender, bid, propose, move, or to offer something. So the common, ordinary meaning would be of to tender would be to simply make an offer or present this. And as Justice Wilcox pointed out by his question, we have to apply common everyday business practices and the common sense approach. And in the practice, when we tender a policy limit or tender the amounts, we don't send a check along to the plaintiff to whom we're making the offer.
Why not? Why wouldn't you want to send a check or send something to the clerk, for example?
Well,
and they do in some cases. I know that I've had cases where they tender and they put the entire policy limit out of their reach.
The question about depositing with the court, depositing the sum with the court, serves a different purpose. Typically, when the amounts, the policy limits are deposited with the clerk of courts, then the insurance company seeks a declaration or of its rights to be able to walk away from the defense of its insured. Country Mutual here made the decision that it was not going to walk away from the defense of its insured. Therefore, they did not have the incentive to deposit the money into court. In regards to sending a check to the plaintiff's attorney, by the time the second letter was sent, the one in February of 1991, Country Mutual had already been advised once that the policy limits, the offer of the policy limits, was unacceptable. And so again, common sense would dictate, and also the Kansas case that we referred to in our brief, the CANN versus Farmers Insurance Company, that there's no, if the offer has already been rejected once, if the offer is going to be rejected, it would be futile to send the check to the claimant. And the petitioner here has used the term that there are certain formalities that should be done before the court construes it as an effective tender. Now, there's, again, using common sense, there's common sense would dictate against having this formality that the check is sent to the plaintiff or claimant without there being some sort of meeting of the minds that there is an agreement. There was a question posed about, and the petitioner talked in terms of there should be something more. For instance, the terms should be set forth along with the offer of the policy limits. And in fact, the letters here do set forth the terms, which were a full release of Country Mutual and its insured, Ronald Trace. So some of the terms were set forth here. It's correct that the terms of the release were not set forth. For instance, a pairing or release, but there was no reason to get into those terms because the plaintiff or Mr. Weimer's counsel had indicated that they would not be accepting.
What's the practice when that offer is made in that letter? Is there money set aside in any trust account or any special type of deposit of the insurance company?
With Country Mutual? Any insurance companies in the state of Wisconsin have to set forth a certain amount of money on claims known as reserves for a particular claim, and the insurance company will make a determination of what they value the claim at and then set aside that money. Correct. But I don't know, for instance, in this particular case, if Country Mutual took that $100,000 and put it into a separate account. I don't know that. The petitioner has cited the Estreen case as an example where the court has said that the money has to be, that the tender has to be unconditional, and it has to be set beyond the use of the person making the tender. Now, a stream can be distinguished from our case because, number one, it was a case arising out of the sale of a land contract, and a case that was decided in equity. And in that case, the plaintiff, a stream, had had the use of the property, had the rents accruing to him, and had also not paid the sellers. Another distinction is that on the date of the settlement closing conference in the Estreen case, Mr. Estreen showed up and attempted to change the terms of the settlement and said that I'm going to pay you X amount, whereas before we had decided that I would be responsible for some of the taxes. Now I'm expecting you to be responsible for some of the taxes. So it wasn't an unconditional tender as was in the present case. Again, the key in determining a construction in an insurance policy situation is a common everyday meaning, and we submit that common everyday meaning is that set forth in the dictionary definitions, and that would be would equate with an offer. And interestingly, in the Novak case, which was cited by both the petitioner and the Court of Appeals, and us, they cited the Black's Law Dictionary. And again, we would again assert, though, that the correct definition would be that is found in the common everyday dictionary. But even in that portion of Black cited by Novak, they, and in commentary on it, equated tender with offer. Not a situation, not saying that tender was a deposit into court or a actual payment to the plaintiff. Therefore, Your Honors, we would ask that tender be construed such that the letter sent to the plaintiff, Mr. Weimer, or the petitioner, would be classified as a tender under the policy, thereby limiting Country Mutual's obligation on interest in this case.
What's the difference in McPhee? How do you distinguish McPhee then?
Well, McPhee only goes so far in that, and we are in agreement with McPhee in terms of where they say that if it would not have been, McPhee said that we would be responsible, that the insurance company was responsible for all the interest because there wasn't a payment, tender, or deposit in court. Under the policy in McPhee, all three of those were options to the insurance company. The insurance company did none of those, and we don't attempt to distinguish McPhee in the sense that its ruling would be correct in that the terms of the policy require Country Mutual to pay all interest if there was not a payment or a tender.
What's the matter with just requiring the insurance company to put the money in court?
What's the matter, the problem with that?
I mean, it's simple. I mean, I'm trying to look for a bright line, easy way of handling the situation. Just say the insurance company should deposit the money in court and with the statement that it be released for liability.
That certainly is an option, but we have to look at the terms of each individual policy, and because this policy uses the term tender, and the way we think tender should be defined, the letters would suffice to be a tender of those offers, thus limiting Country Mutual's exposure to the interest.
The insurance company won't be earning the interest on the money, and the clerk of courts will have all this money sitting in its account, too.
Correct. Correct.
Mm-hmm. What's the matter with that?
Clerk of courts?
There's nothing a matter with it, and in fact, that is one of the options available to the insurance company. But again, normally, when the money is deposited into court. That's coupled with an insurance company attempting to get a declaration that it no longer has a duty to defend and then walking away from its defense of its insured, which is something that Country Mutual decided not to do here. They defended Mr. Trace. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Turpin?
First of all, I stand corrected on the ambiguity issue. I apologize to the court. I misunderstood the question. I thought the question dealt with whether ambiguity was a fact situation which was addressed in testimony, and it absolutely was addressed by the trial court, but it wasn't addressed in a testimonial sort of situation. With respect to the post-verdict interest, I just have a few comments. First of all, there are two aspects to the post-verdict interest issue. One is from a perspective of Mr. Trace. Mr. Trace has a liability policy, and he has a significant exposure here. Mr. Trace is interested in having his exposure limited by payment by his insurance carrier of interest on the entire verdict. Otherwise, Mr. Trace ends up paying interest on the entire verdict. And therefore, I think it's important, or it's the position of the appellant, that it's important from the court for the court to look at this from a standpoint of Mr. Trace as well.
Well,
yes, sir?
Well, counsel, that raises the concern that I have. The letters that are in the indexes here indicate an offer to settle that I presume you would agree had, at any time, had Weimer written back and said, we accept your offer, they would have been legally bound to pay, the Country Insurance would have been legally bound to pay the $100,000, correct?
Well, sir, that's what counsel for the respondent says in his brief. I did not research that issue. I thought that that probably was not true. I thought that we had to have a formal entering into a settlement agreement in order for that to be binding. And so I'm not prepared here to say that either side of that issue is correct.
Okay, well, let's assume that that they are correct, that this constituted a binding offer, and that an acceptance would have created a binding contract. Now, why is it fair to hold Country Insurance liable for interest beyond that amount?
Well, from a standpoint of a contract, as you use the term here, I think that there are two things to consider. First of all is the policy itself. The policy itself has chosen to use, or the insurance company has chosen to use, the word tender. The word tender in legal circles, according to the appellate court, has certain meaning, and that meaning requires that money be put away, put out of the use of the party who's seeking to take advantage of the term tender. That is not being done in the hypothetical which you postulate. Secondly, I think that a situation such as that presented by Country Mutual in this case was not an unconditional offer. There were, it said that its offer dealt with some sort of release of liability, but it did not articulate the terms and conditions which it was imposing insofar as the release was concerned. And there were other parties in this case as well. And so I don't believe that it would be appropriate for this court to conclude that simply a letter to the opposing counsel indicating we'll pay policy limits without stating what it expected in return for those policy limits would be appropriate. I don't know if that answers the question or not, but...
Well, the letter certainly did ask for a release of all liability against them and the client. In exchange for that, they're willing to give $100,000.
Well, that's what the letter said, but it did not include any release. It did not include any further elucidation with respect to what it expected in regarding full release.
Mr. Rubin, is it your position then that even if they deposited the $100,000 to the clerk of courts and written the letter they had written, that that was not a sufficient tender under the policy?
Oh, if they would have deposited the money with the clerk of court, Your Honor, that...
But not articulated what the terms of the release would have been.
If they would have deposited the money with the clerk of court, it would have put the money beyond their control, as the appellate court said they had to do in order to effectuate...
But how does that satisfy the problem that you're raising, that you don't... whether it's a conditional offer and you don't know what the terms are? It seems to me that that's the objection, as opposed to whether or not it was sitting in a bank account at the clerk's office, or whether the insurance company had it. I mean, I don't understand how that helps your other problem that you're arguing that there's no clear release, the terms of the release weren't provided.
Well, it seems to me, Your Honor, that it's incumbent upon a party who is offering money to settle a case to also indicate the terms that it expects to...
So your position is they should have done that as well as deposited the money?
Yes. Or if they would have sent the money and the release, that would have probably have sufficed.
What if they had just written the letter, made the offer, and sent the release? Would you say that was sufficient?
I would say that it would, again, depend on whether it was an unconditional offer when you read the release in conjunction with the letter. But if it's an unconditional offer in which they send the check and release, then I think the tender has been made.
Forget the check. How about the release itself with the offer? Is that sufficient?
I don't think that's sufficient, Your Honor, because the at least under the appellate court's rationale, because the appellate court says that money has to be set aside beyond the use of the party who's seeking to take advantage of the tender.
And that's using the stream case.
Yes, sir.
If the insurance company had placed it with the clerk, is it the clerk's money until it's paid out to somebody else? Or can the insurance company renege by saying, we found that there was fraud by our insurer, we found that the facts are different than those originally investigated, we want our money back. Can they get their money back?
Well, Your Honor, that poses a...
That's another question.
...a significant question involving a number of facts. I think that's fact-dependent. Generally speaking, I would say no, the insurance company could not get its money back. But on the other hand, if fraud were involved, that would open up a new issue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Bergman, the case ends. The students from Edgewood High School should remain